And in this time slot, each and every morning on TSN Mornings, we welcome in a presentation of the Myers Automotive Group from NBC Sports. It is Pierre McGuire. Good morning, Pierre. How are you?
Steve, you liked it so much, you came back pretty quick. Morning to you. Hello, Sean.
Morning, Pierre.
Well, it was a grueling two-day work week for JR, so we needed another week, okay? That's what he needed to do. I'm more than happy to do it. Love talking hockey with you, Pierre. So we'll get to the World Junior stuff in just a moment. It's Monday, and we're all wondering, are you hearing anything? Is this the week we get something definitive from the NHL and the NHLPA as to when a season will be beginning?
I'm going to be cautious on this. One of the things that makes me very cautious is the fact that we're not hearing anything from any general managers. There's been a cone of silence. The only people you're getting any kind of information from are either people from the league office, Bill Daly or Gabe Bettman, or people from the PA. And we're not hearing anything from owners, really, outside of Mr. Melnyk's comments last week that started the week, I think, with a ripple effect, positive more so than negative. And that's it. So when that happens, my experience has been over time that when managers are cut out of the loop, and it seems like they are right now, things are probably not trending in the right direction. So I think there's a lot of work to do before this thing gets settled. When you don't have any leaks at all coming from management level type people and you don't see any, they've probably been cut out of the process.
Pierre, does this in the last week feel more like a lockout now versus necessarily a whatever COVID-19 alert?
I don't want to say that because I think that's too strong, but I totally see your point on it, Sean. That's why I said what I just said.
Yeah.
The cone of silence is up, and that usually means there's significant negotiation going on at one level or another, probably at the highest level. There might be some back-channel negotiation. But again, for over time, my experience has been when certain parties have been cut out of it, and you could probably call any of the 31 GMs in the league, not counting Ronnie Francis, who's obviously not really involved at this point, but if you were to call any of the other 31 managers, I think most of them would say, I have no idea what's happening. And that tells me, again, this is at an ownership level, this is at a board of governor level at the highest end, and probably at a presidency level. So that tells me that there's a lot of room for negotiation here.
From your vantage point, Pierre, is there an obvious angle for some wiggle room on negotiation? Because it all comes down to money, as it always does, right? Whether it's going to be escrow, whether it's going to be deferred money. Is there a solution as you look at it?
Yeah, the owners are going to have to wrap their head around the fact that if they want to play hockey, they're going to have to do it and take significant losses because you're not going to get fans back in the building. So That's the thing that's been going on, and I've been telling, you know, JR and Sean about it since the third week of, the pub in Edmonton where I was. I was hearing it from people then, 3 weeks into it, that we were going to have a really difficult time because of the financial losses that were being accumulated by ownership groups around the league during the bubble. And it proved out to be correct. So that's the issue, Steve, is I feel terrible for the players, first of all, because they signed a good conscience, a longstanding agreement, 6 years extension on a collective bargaining agreement. They put the work in. They made sacrifices. They played by the rules. They were part of escrow, and they've paid into their escrow. And I respect the players. I think what the players did last summer was phenomenal. Not a little bit good, off the charts good. And I also understand, and this is where it gets a little bit dicey and slippery, I also understand the point of view of ownership. If you can't get people into the building, you can't have a functioning business. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Last week, the Tampa Bay Lightning laid off 30 people. I can tell you from my heart of hearts, no way would Jeffrey Vinnick ever in a million years want to lay off anybody, anybody. He's just that type of a human being. He has no choice. His business people are telling him, here's the problem. This is where we are. So I'm not blaming the players. I'm not blaming the owners. This is a really hard conundrum to figure out. This is an amazingly difficult situation for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's losses for the owners, just how much they want to accept here. Back to your point on the managers, though, this has also been a trend in the league for a long time where the managers, quite simply, in a lot of things outside of hockey operations, are no longer involved at the league level, right?
No, that's true. That's fair. But usually you'll have older managers, meaning experienced managers, whose owners really respect and appreciate them. the owners will bring them into the loop and share information with them. And more times than not, those managers will share that information. It's like a little club. It is a little club. There are very few of these jobs. And so that information will get shared amongst their peer group, and then eventually it'll find its way out. You're not seeing any of that. How long have we been, you know, gone from the bubble in Edmonton since the last week of September? You haven't seen any manager saying anything about when we're going to return to play. It's just they have no idea. So what I'm saying is they've basically been cut out of this decision-making process because it's an ownership situation that the owners are going to have to deal with along with Gary Bettman.
As we all look for tea leaves, can we read anything into the fact that some players have started to end their loans overseas? I see Kotkaniemi is going to be done, and presumably to prepare to come back to North America. Do you read anything into that, that that's starting to happen, Pierre?
Well, I think some of it's starting to happen. Again, you talk to agents as well, and agents are hopeful because without playing, they don't get paid. So they need the players back playing too. And so I think they're wistfully and hopefully thinking that they can get their guys back in, and then once they get back in, then camps can start, and then everybody can get going. But we'll see. I mean, you know, again, Kotkaniemi won't have if we don't have NHL. I'm not saying we won't. I'm just using this as a you know, something that people can look at. If we were not to have NHL hockey this year, he could still go back home and play. That's not going to be an issue for him. There are other guys that won't be as lucky. So, do I think we'll have NHL hockey? Yes, I do. When we'll have it, I don't know. But I would think that players are getting antsy right now.
Yeah, I think everybody is. And to that, Pierre, it continues to be discussed, but is it almost an automatic for where the climate is at that we will end up seeing an all-Canadian division?
Oh, no, though. If there's hockey, and I believe there will be, there'll be an all-Canadian division. Again, that's something we talked about going back to Edmonton, and people are like, really, you think that'll happen? I'm like, yeah, that's going to happen because of the border. The border's closed. And you know, that's pretty significant. You know, you've traveled back and forth so many times over the course of your scouting career and management career. You know how important it is to get across the border and have to work in either the United States or in Canada. That's just the reality of the hockey business. This is the way we're built.
All right, let's move on to a little World Junior Selection Camp talk here. Dylan Cousins looks like he got a little bit nicked up, something to keep an eye on. Had the scrimmage last night, and maybe we'll start to have the first cuts tomorrow. Now, this is a unique camp. It's so long, and we discussed this in our time together last week as well. You know, how difficult, and, you know, Fair's got nothing to do with it. I get that. But there's some guys that are still in quarantine from the NCAA that haven't had a chance to really show themselves. There are some players that have had COVID, Ridley Greig, and haven't had a chance here. So it's not fair, but you can't keep these numbers forever, and it looks like cuts are coming.
Yeah, I think they'll make the cuts. They won't make a ton of mistakes. The ones that will bother me, if they are done, will be the political ones. And we'll see. It's too early to say how much politics will play in this. I think for some of the players that have been invited, it's realistic that they probably know they're not going to have a long shelf life through this process. It's just the way it works. And, you know, again, we'll see how it plays out. But I wouldn't prejudge anything. But I just tell you this, Canada's going to be really good. They're not going to be a little bit good. They're going to be really, really good. And, you know, I'm keeping my antenna up like everybody else, just watching and trying to evaluate.
If they make cuts this week and get down to 32, Pierre, they've got a couple of preliminary games around the 21st of December. That span of, 3.5 weeks, does that seem a little bit long for that group, or do you like those numbers?
No, it's long. I talked to a bunch of NHL decision makers, and they would never do that, you know, with their groups to have that long camp with that many people. So, no, it's really difficult. But, again, this is a unique time. There's no perfect solution. I think they're trying to get it right. There's a lot of pressure, obviously, because it's being played on home soil. There's just such a level of professionalism with Hockey Canada and this event in particular. They don't want to drop the ball. So it's everybody's going to have their own opinion, but I think more times than not, you got to give Hockey Canada the benefit of the doubt. They do it right so many times compared to how many times they do it wrong. They do it right far more than they do it wrong.
Pierre, Simber brought this up last hour. Do you get the sense, as we develop goaltenders in this country, and it's no disrespect to the five that are at this camp, but you know, there's not that scouting star power level, but it's not like we've seen that all the time. There are many examples of goaltenders having fantastic tournaments that kind of came out of nowhere. Is that just one of those things? What do you account for development of young Canadian goaltenders? Because it seems like recently it's Carter Hart, and just a lot of other guys.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. For whatever reason, it's been a little bit shallow in terms of talent pool. I don't know if that's cyclical or not. You know, I'm party to the Brodeur situation and how he came along. You know, you watch a player like Carey Price. I mean, there's a big difference from when Carey Price got drafted in 05 and Marty Brodeur got drafted in 90. You know, Trevor Kidd was in the same draft with Brodeur. So it's different. I mean, Sean's a goalie. He could probably speak to it better than I could, but I would just say I think the goaltending thing is more cyclical than anything else.
Yeah, I ask you, Pierre, I think it's dried up, and my only summary I can kind of look at is that for whatever reason, well, I don't know how much of our population is 6'4", at the end of the day, these Finnish, Swedish, and Russian kids and some others coming over, they're just quite simply, in my estimation, better athletes than the kids that want to play goal here in Canada.
Because what's happened, well, in their country, it's not as prominent as maybe in North America and in Canada and in the United States, obviously, North America. But they're better athletes that are big are playing hockey because it's a vehicle for them. Better athletes can play baseball. They can play basketball. They can play football. A lot of those goaltenders that you're talking about, and I'll use Vasilevsky as an example. If you were to walk in to an NFL dressing room, and just hang out with the tight ends, and all of a sudden you invite Vasilevsky in, he might be as big or bigger than most of the tight ends in the National Football League. If you were to bring in, you know, any of the top tall, and I mean big goalies in the league, it would be very much the same. The reason I bring up Vasilevsky's name, I'll never forget being at the All-Star game in San Jose a couple of years ago, and Vasilevsky sitting next to Henrik Lundqvist. And Lundqvist, who had played against them, had never seen him in street clothes or in his, you know, workout clothes. And he looks at me and goes, I can't believe how big this guy is. Like, even for a hockey player, and the big now, this guy is just so much bigger. You're like, whoa, this is freaky. But that's where it is. And I think that's part of what Sean's talking about, Steve, is that a lot of those countries, that, you know, whether it's Finland, Sweden, or Russia, they're better athletes go right into hockey, especially their bigger guys.
Well, and to the size point as well. So Craig Button filed a report from the camp last night. In his opinion, Brett Brochu is kind of pulled ahead at this stage here. Long way to go. He's the only goaltender there listed at under 6 foot. He's listed at 5'11". So I went back to the NHL for the past season. There were only three goaltenders in the entire league last year, Pierre, that were listed under 6 foot. And one of them played in the Stanley Cup final, in Anton Hudobin. And you're looking at Saros and you're looking at Halak. And that's it. Are we ever going to see goaltenders, you know, of a smaller stature make a bit of a comeback in terms of being evaluated to potentially play in the NHL, or is it just a big man's position now?
You're going to have to ask Manny Legacy. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
No, but it's going to be tougher and tougher for smaller guys to get in and play. There's no question. Just because of, I think one of the things that helped change us a lot for the size of the goalies, and this was talked about in 05 when the rule changes went into place, the stretch pass, the zero tolerance and obstruction, and the inability of defenders to put their sticks parallel to the ice to defend against the opposition. You put those three things in, it allows players to have more time and space to shoot pucks and elevate pucks. And when you can elevate a puck in shorter time, which they can with these new sticks, it makes it tougher for smaller goalies, because if the smaller goalie drops, you're going to get high by the ears quite often. So that's... those are three of the, I think, three and even four because of the new sticks that have made it really difficult for smaller goalies to survive.
Pierre, I see big picture. Johnny Gardner, the longtime coach at Avon Old Farm, setting some records.
Unbelievable. John Gardner's been at Avon Old Farm since the mid-1980s. He got his 800th win this weekend against Salisbury School, which is an elite school, develops tons of players over time. And I've known John ever since he started at Avon, and I'm blown away by the fact that he got his 800th win. The only man in prep school hockey that's close to him is Kenny Martin at Belmont Hill, who has 707 career wins. And a person like John Gardner has been doing this selflessly for so many years, and he could have left a million times to go to really good college jobs. But I'll give you a laundry list of some of the players that he's coached over time. Jonathan Quick, Nick Bonino, Cam Atkinson, Patrick Harper, who's about to turn pro, he's at Boston University right now, won a World Junior goal with Team USA. Christopher Higgins, Nick Dimitrakos, who played in San Jose. But the best player he ever coached there was Brian Leetch. The best player he ever coached was Brian Leetch. And Brian would tell you over time just how much John meant to his career, especially early on. with the Rangers. So what an amazing achievement. 800 wins in prep school hockey is amazing when you consider back in the day when he first started, they were probably only playing 25 games. Now they play 30. You know, you start doing the math. That's an amazing, amazing record. So congratulations to Coach Gardner and Avon Oldfarms. The Wing Beavers, Sean, that's their name.
Yeah, I remember, well, Brian Leach was the first one coming out of there, played against him in the World Junior. Also to that, Pierre, just bigger picture. It's been really nice with Quinnipiac and Yale. My buddy Keith Elaine, the longtime coach there. We have really seen some growth through the Connecticut, New York, over to Long Island area of actual players going to the National Hockey League.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, you're going to see Trevor Zegras play with Anaheim. You're going to see Spencer Knight play with Florida at some point. Those are Connecticut kids. The Connecticut development programs have been phenomenal. Quinnipiac and Yale have helped. Sacred Heart is a real sleeper team in Division One. Nobody talks about them enough. And Mike Cavanaugh is a coach at University of Connecticut. Sean, he has done, and he, for all those years, he built those Boston College teams for Jerry York that won national championships. He's a head coach at UConn now, and he's putting his...
Have they finally gotten an indoor rink?
They have one, but not the one, not the one they want. Not the one they want. They yeah. have one, but they still play their game, their bigger games, whether it's against BU and BC. They're in Hockey East and UMass Amherst. They play at the old Hartford Civic.
Trivia for the listeners. Who's the most famous UConn ice hockey alumni?
Todd Krieger.
Exactly.
And I'll
he had the wheels story? Back in the day. Great guy.
Oh, did he ever. Best bow-legged skater I saw since Gilbert Perreault.
No, he was, but, for sure.
So let me just give you a quick story on that one. And if Roy Malark is listening, he can back me up on this. I was coaching at Babson College, and Roy was a general manager of the New Haven Nighthawks. And they were going into a playoff series. And New Haven at the time was being run by L.A. So Roy was working for them. And Roy called us up because we had just eliminated UConn in a playoff series. And he said, who are the best players in Division II, III that you know of? And I said, well, the best kid I've seen is a kid that plays for me, Tommy Sasso, but he's been drafted by Quebec. The next best player is Todd Krieger, and I think he'll play in the NHL. So they brought Todd Krieger, I'm not kidding you, from UConn, which is in Storrs, Connecticut, down to New Haven. That's about an hour ride. He played in that playoff game. And then I think there was a team by the name of the Washington Capitals that signed him. But that's how Krieger got his opportunity in pro hockey. His first games were played with the New Haven Nighthawks.
Yeah.
And because we had knocked him out in a playoff series.
Yeah. Egan Wheel. I think Krieger started out in Hartford, Pierre. And then we ended up bringing him to Washington. Yeah. Like, we brought all the Hartford players back. And also, would you agree that New Haven with 3,000 fans was one of the loudest buildings and maybe some of the ugliest people you've ever seen?
Oh, my
goodness. No, I'm not going to do that. But you know what, Stevie, just
that good morning.
No longer, that building's no longer there.
Oh, man.
It used to be right by 95.
Oh.
You pull in there and the parking lot, Stevie, was underneath the rink.
No. Well, the original parking lot, Pierre, was on the roof, and it was condemned the night they opened building because it was too heavy.
It was. When you go in there, it was everything you thought a minor league rink would be. It was dark. It was dingy. There was cigarette smoke all over the place. It was rough.
I remember going there, Pierre, because we heard about Yale growing up, and we took the bus in from Baltimore. We used to stay at the Howard Johnson right on 95
everybody,
there.
But everybody
it was bad. And then the rink was so loud, and as typical to me, I was usually the backup goaltender, and they'd be giving it to me the whole game. The trick that they would do is that I'd be sitting there. They'd take ice out of their drink. And they would whip it, and it would hit off the glass just on the side. If it didn't scare the bejesus out of me, and you jump up and you look over, and there they are. But that was really the transition of the old school. That was where the American League was just starting to get younger, but you still had a lot of the old school veteran players.
It was that was a rough town. There's no question. And you know what, Yale. When you go to Yale, and whether you coach there, or play there, or go to school there. It's almost like an oasis in the middle of the city. They're trying their best to really clean up New Haven, and I think they've done a pretty successful job of it, but it's still got some work to do.
All right, there was a minor league story time. I love it. More of that to come here, hopefully, throughout the week. Pierre, always appreciate the visit, and we'll do it again tomorrow.
Oh, awesome visiting with you, Steve. Take care. Be safe, everybody.
Hey, Pierre. Also on that team was Mr. Couturier. We used to hang out with Sylvain, Mario Gosselin, and Craig Duncanson. And that New Haven team, I'd say pound for pound, some of the best beer drinkers in all of pro sports.
that's very strong.
Where has time gone, hey?
Oh, man. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah. 1200. Well, it went off the rails towards the end of the conversation with Pierre Maguire, thanks to Simmer. Shocker. Okay.
Yeah.
But my takeaway there is, Hammer's hometown is off the hook for ugliest people. Because I think you've made that reference to our poor friend Matt Hamer before.
No,
it's New Haven now.
No. We're number two.
It's just interesting experiences, Lordy. We are out of Baltimore, which going down to the United States as a 20-year-old living in downtown Baltimore, to say the very least, just an eye-opener. And we, when we talk about different things, and certainly in times in Ottawa, we have some things that happen. But when you talk about danger and traveling around the United States and going to these inner cities, and for New Haven, you know, you have Princeton, you have Harvard. When you go to there, like I said, and first of all, Yale's real cool to see. It's kind of an old Gothic feel to it. But the city itself, and you're also going most times, Lloydie, in the middle of the winter. You're right on the ocean there. It's cold, staying at the old Howard Johnson's, and just the atmosphere and the feel of it, just not what I expected back in the day. So it's always those memories that kind of stick out, and also had a lot of fun.
The part about they had to condemn the parking garage immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, I'm going to throw this out there, might be a design flaw.
Yeah.
Okay,
no,
with building a rink.
No, no. Again, and that was it was this big rusty cage on the top, and exactly that. I don't know if it was just when they went to get permit, but it was no, you can't. First of all, the thing is too heavy. You put cars in, going to collapse. Now, not a bad rink, and there was also a transition where. Did Ottawa early on not send their players to New Haven when they first came into the National Hockey League? Because I think Don McAdam at the time was the coach. And that was before they went up to Prince Edward Island. So you were into transfers. And I don't know if that's where they originally hooked up with Roy Malarker. And also to the point, and I remember vividly, is that much like in Portland, Maine, the guys in New Haven would rent these pretty nice houses and cottages along the ocean because they were seasonal, Lloydie, so nobody would live there. And just remember us going over, and it's Couturier's dad, and that's how long, that's 1990, to Mario Gosselin, who was a bit of a hero of mine and quite a character. And, you know, this is a time when the American League, I guess all sports, but, you know, hey, we were certainly there to play, but you knew everybody on the teams, and it had a different feel to it when you'd play there because you know, a lot of the cities, you're pretty anonymous where you're playing. So seeing old buddies and hanging out and having a couple of pops after the game, nothing wrong with that.
Well, it's funny you bring up Mario Gosselin. I haven't heard that name in years. And Simmer, he was one of my favorites as a young kid as well, because I remember the first high-level hockey game I ever went to, my dad took me, and it was an exhibition game to get ready for Sarajevo.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was
yeah,
at the Civic
yeah,
Center.
Yeah.
And Mario Gosselin was on that Team Canada team, the place was packed, and I remember just being enthralled watching him play, and I became a bit of a fan and tracked him through his Nordiques career.
Yeah, and that would have started around the time, or just before that, when Dave King, we had a full-time national team, Lloydie, and it was really cool. You go to that roster in 84, and I think you've got, what, Kirk Muller, Dineen, with James Patrick.
Tippett, Driver.
Yeah, it was a real nice looking team, and Mario was just a real character. Can still picture those uniforms because we haven't gone back to that more of a blue and a red, right, with the Hockey Canada crest. And I also, in 86, they would go around and play. And at that time, we were still very fast. And with the Soviet Union, didn't matter if the players were all anonymous. They'd send these teams over, and they'd tour around, and they'd end up training with Dave and playing against them. And I actually went on one of their tours in 86 when my season ended in the Sioux. We went to little places like Elliott Lake, I think up to Rouyn-Noranda, back down to North Bay, end up going home from there. What is really neat, if you track back, though, with Dave King, and I'll say this in the truest sense, a lot of those guys, Lloydie, the Dave Kings and Tom Watts and even Tom Rennies, almost all of them are actually educators first. You know, you know, and that's even Roger Nielsen, Mike Keenan, for that matter.
Brian Murray.
Yeah, exactly. And to me, that approach is really interesting. Because when you get into the philosophical sense of coaching to develop versus necessarily coaching to win, not that you can't do both, but the amount of players that they produced, and if you go through some of those old teams, the amount of guys that, and I'm just thinking in 86 when I was there, Newell Brown was on the team, the late, great Zarly Zalapsky, one of the Benning brothers. There was a whole crew, but there's a bunch of guys that came through that program under Dave King that went on to be very good coaches as well. Like, he was a real mentor, and that program, like a lot of things at the time in the mid-80s, was so far ahead of the NHL. Like, Dave King had such an international feel for training, for practicing, for skill development, that, you know what, we've caught up now, but it took a long time for the rest of Canada to figure it out.
No, you bring up a good point about having the teaching background. That's a skill set that translates, you know, especially at that level, right? You're dealing with young players, especially. It just makes a lot of sense. It's one thing to have the knowledge, and there's so many people that come through hockey that have great knowledge. Yeah. It's another thing to be able to impart that knowledge and explain it properly and pass it on.
Yeah, and you know, you look here to the Ontario Hockey League, and I'll say the best two programs right now are Dale Hunter, and in his own sense, the way he approaches it, very good teacher, and also say to Andre Tournier, the program that he's gotten here, and I don't know his background, but I will say, and I'm not going to say it's all, but one thing I do appreciate that when you do go to college and you have that mentality of coaching or even prep school, there's a combination of hockey in that, but what has happened in junior hockey, especially for some lower-end teams, Lloydie, the poor coach himself is so darn worried every day about his own job that his approach is so different. You really just go into survival mode, right? Versus, and again, I understand it's a business, you want to win, but in a perfect world, you'd like to have the model the Ottawa 67s have, where, hey, you're accomplishing both, and you're not only developing good hockey players, but you're developing tremendous young men.
All right, speaking of coaching, I just sent you a story a short while ago, Simmer. I want to bring this up here and just get your opinion. Now, COVID has affected everything in our lives, okay?
Yeah.
And this story here is an accusation of using COVID as a crutch, possibly, here. Okay, so if people might have missed it on the weekend, Clemson and Florida State, that game was ended up being canceled because of COVID concerns. Now, Clemson head coach Dabo Swinney doesn't believe that COVID-19 was why the game against Florida State was called off. And here's the quote. This game was not canceled because of COVID. COVID was just an excuse to cancel the game. To me, Florida State administration forfeited the game. Now, the ACC postponed the game between Clemson and Florida just hours before kickoff after the team's medical staffs couldn't agree on how to continue with the game. There were concerns from the Seminoles stemmed from a symptomatic Tigers player who tested positive for the virus on Friday and was on the team flight. Had it tested positive. So that was the big red flag and the concern. But Swinney maintains that the standard wasn't met. They should have been able to hammer something out. And he's basically saying Florida State was chicken and didn't want to play, and they used COVID as an excuse.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, if it's Florida State and that's the case, good on you. I mean, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. As far as a ranking or anything else, Florida State's not a very good team anymore, right? I mean, that when you think of the Florida schools, the decline, although the University of Florida is ranked 6th in the country. I guess you don't want to get embarrassed against Clemson. Is that kind of the ideal?
They've lost 6 of 8. Yeah, they're not very good this year.
No, and that's a trend that continues. You know, we all joked, or not joke, but growing up, everything was Florida, Florida State, and University of Miami. So, I don't know. I guess to sum it up, I would never be surprised by any of it. And when you're also Clemson, and I'm assuming this would have been the return of Trevor Lawrence, would it not?
Exactly, you know? Yes, and that's a big part of this as well.
Although their backup didn't look too shabby either. And if you're Trevor Lawrence, do you at the back, you know, again, I know he wants to get drafted first overall, probably, you get your cash. Like, you have to watch Joe Burrow. You have to watch Sam Darnold, who is a good quarterback. You have to look at this and say, man, do I, as talented as I am, I mean, I remember them 2 years ago, right? You know, was it Eisen? Rich Eisen's a big Jets fan, doing this incredible, like, lead-in about the savior coming into town, and we finally going to have a quarterback. Now he's going to get, what, cut at the end of the season as they end up drafting this guy? You must look at this and just say, man, I wish I could pull a little John Elway action here and go to a more stable spot. And as I said, some of these young quarterbacks coming into bad teams, you just never have a chance.
But I've never bought the fact, and I know he had to back off some comments, be Trevor Lawrence, and said, listen, I'm just not going to say anything anymore because people are just going to twist what I have to say and read into it and what have you. There's no way he's staying in school.
Like, no.
It doesn't make any sense. You want to talk about the injury situation or what have you. He's got nothing left to prove. And really, on the surface, and I know the Jets have been a tire fire of an organization, but you know, when they draft him first overall, you would think that's going to be an attraction to make the team better. Players are going to want to play with him and be a part of that with the Jets. So he is that level of prospect that that comes along just once in a generation, it seems. It doesn't happen very often when you see this highly touted of a quarterback come out of the NCAA and everybody is just tabbing for stardom right away. And at the end of it as well, I mean, who wouldn't want to be successful in that marketplace, in the New York marketplace? There's no way he's staying in school. That was kind of put to bed.
No, it's not. Now, I watched some of their games. Last year was Tua. Before that, Mahomes wasn't thought the same way to Lamar Jackson. I understand what you're saying. I will say in that market, though, first of all, the risks that you're taking and going into, and the other thing, if you've been to New York, hey, being on the New York Jets, and I don't care about Joe Namath, that's long gone. It's a big difference in profile compared to being on the New York Giants, right? Like that's the Islanders to the Rangers. It's the Knicks to the Nets. It's the Yankees to the Mets. It's a secondary thing, and I know when you go into accomplish New York, it's a big thing, but I'll be honest with you, Lloydie, unless you're going to Jacksonville or a small market, I think the NFL, these guys, and this guy's such a brand and name, if you go to the NFL and are fairly successful in almost any market, you can do quite well for yourself. I don't know that it necessarily, and I'll just say this is a comparison. I know he has zero personality. Like, who's made more money off the field, Tom Brady or Eli Manning? And I know, Eli, it's only 2-6, but I'm not positive that that's necessarily the case anymore. I think that these guys, like I said, for him, again, you don't want to go to a small market, but you go to a decent program. I'll say even the crazy how bad the NFC East is, it's still a pretty big deal.
Well, and we brought this up before as well, but there, you know, Trevor Lawrence is going to be the next one, we think, absolutely for sure. But there, the last few years, there's a lot of promise with a lot of really good young quarterbacks coming in and finding instant success. And that's important because, you know, Tom Brady is still a very good player. So is Roethlisberger. Phillip Rivers is still good. Aaron Rodgers still. Drew Brees. You know, like the core of the star power of an era it's coming to an end here.
Yeah.
And entertaining football is you got to have something good at the quarterback position.
Yeah,
so the NFL's in a good spot.
No, gosh, it is. And think of now, I don't know, Baker Mayfield. Sam Darnold, personally, in the right spot, I think he'd end up being fine. But no, when you go to Mahomes, to Lamar Jackson, to looking at Kyler Murray or Jan, I just am really fascinated to look at the different spots because I look at Tom Brady. I know it's crazy where he's drafted, but, you know, not that he was going to be a starter anyway, but the ability to apprentice, and I say the same thing with Mahomes, even with Lamar Jackson playing a year behind, he played a full year behind Flacco, did he not?
Yes.
Like I just don't really understand for the most difficult position in sports, this idea that you would risk that much to throw somebody in sink or swim. And I'll even use Miami. It was surprising when they decided on Tua, but it's not a bad thing. But at the same time, it's not like they cut Fitzpatrick, right? They're saying, listen, here's your job, but we've also got a fallback situation. And we also have a tremendous veteran here to support you where, like I said, I look at these other times and other situations. I even wonder long-term, nothing to do with injury. And I know Joe Burrow is off to a great start, but man, it takes a lot to turn around a whole program.
Well, interesting that specifically what the Dolphins did yesterday. This is how how the team is faring. And I would think if you asked Flores and the Dolphins in general, do they think that they're heading into yesterday a little ahead of where maybe they thought they could be? If the truth serum came out, probably, right? They'd won 5 in a row, 2 of those wins coming under Fitzpatrick. You've turned the ball and given it to Tua. But the fact that they had a chance to tie Buffalo atop the division with that win yesterday, and the game was still, they could still have it, and they made the call to bench Tua and bring back in Fitzmagic, right, hoping for some magic, didn't happen here. I think that speaks to how things have kind of changed in expectation level in Miami.
Well,
it's about winning. It's always about winning. Don't get
sure
us wrong.
For sure it is, yeah. And you know, again, also to the mentality of when you've got veteran players, hey, this is awesome that this guy's going to come in, but under Fitzmagic, you're doing okay. I want to develop the quarterback. I think that'll take us to the promised land, but I don't have to hand him a job, right? And you even wonder how it went on down in New Orleans. We discussed earlier in the show. I've got to think with Taysom Hill that Drew Brees at the end of the day had a lot to say because it sounded like at the beginning of the week
that was weird.
Jameis Winston was going to be the starting quarterback, and they said they were very divided in it. I really do believe that was Drew Brees going to Sean Payton and saying, "Listen, I'm going to work with him. I'm going to get him comfortable." And hey, they ended up going out and getting a huge victory yesterday.
And we'll see what they do because it doesn't look like Breeze is anywhere close. Collapsed lung and 12 fractures in the ribs. It's not like he's on the horizon here to come back. So they won 7 in a row, and Taysom Hill was good enough yesterday, and they keep rolling. And we'll see what happens tonight with that division. They got the Bucks and the Rams to watch, and we'll have it on TSN 1200.
It'd be really interesting too, Lloydie, in the back and forth with, is it most touchdowns between Brady and Breeze? You know,
isn't that a ridiculous thing up in your timeline?
the holding the record, but I wonder how that'll be handled by both athletes, because I would kind of look at Drew Brees and say, for where his game is at, last couple of years, not great in the playoffs, now you get a major injury like this, do you say, listen, I'm going to take a run at it this year, if I'm real successful, maybe I walk out, if I'm not successful, I walk out anyway, or for both of them, how motivated they are? Or is one of them almost looking for notification that the other one's going to let it go, and then you just hang around long enough to make sure it's going to be your record, right?
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. All right, we'll take that top hour break. Hey, let's talk some more NFL, shall we, in our next segment. Each and every Monday, joins TSN Mornings. It's Duke Ellington. That's coming up next on TSN Mornings on TSN 1200.